Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem and Arvind joining you. But this week too, like last week, we have Brother Sai Prakash to join us in continuation of our series where we were discussing about the mind. The mind, as explained by Swami, as explained by Vedanta, the various aspects of the mind, the flaws in the mind, the way by which we can control them. In fact, that is the part we're going to be discussing today, the various vagaries of the mind and how and what we can do to control them and to deal with them. But before that, we will give you a short introduction of probably what we spoke so far. But even before that, let us begin by offering our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet and invite Arvind and Sai Prakash to join all of us. Saram to both of you.
Saram Prem.
I think this is the fourth episode of the series on the mind. So would anybody like to start by giving a brief, clear summary of what you have come across, because that is more needed, I guess.
Since this is most probably will be the concluding session, at least as far as this series is concerned, I think we can go through a quick summary of all that we have done so far. We began with multiple quotations and quotes on what the mind is, and we picked up these quotes from Bhagavan's discourses as well as from the scriptures. And when we just look at all these quotes in the first glance, it definitely is very confusing, because it doesn't give us an idea of what the mind is, whether it's a positive thing, whether it's a negative thing, whether it's a villain, whether it's a hero. So after that, we went into a classification of the mind based on its functions. That's where we came up with the Manas, Buddhi, Chitta, Ahankara framework. And once that framework came up, and once we understood the functions of each of them, where Manas is the working mind, Buddhi is the discrimination, Chitta is the memory, and Ahankara is the identity. All these are four different aspects, the four different functions of the mind. And once we recognize these functions of the mind, it becomes clear to us as to what is the mind being referred to in the various quotes. And I think we classified different quotes based on Manas, Buddhi, Chitta, Ahankara. And this framework gave us a good idea about the existence, the functioning, as well as the interconnections between these different functions of the mind. And again, we made it very clear that it is not as if there are four separate parts of the mind. The whole mind does these four functions, and that's why it's a functional classification. And last week, we just introduced the kind of problems or the kind of difficulties that we face because of the mind, the kind of pollutants that the mind faces. In fact, while introducing them, Bhagwan says, and this is a statement that Swami makes in many of his discourses. He says, "Pashyan napi na pashyati mudho mudho mudho," which actually means, "You see and yet you do not see, you fool, you fool, you fool." And Swami would make this statement very often. Bhagwan introduces the three kinds of defects of the mind, which is mala, vikshepa, and avarna, with this statement of "Pashyan napi na pashyati mudho." He says, "You see, and yet you do not see. Why is this?" To make it easier for us to understand, the example, the analogy of a mirror is given. And he said that when you see, in a normal circumstance, when you look at the mirror, you're supposed to see your reflection very clearly. But if you're looking at the mirror and not seeing your reflection, that is the case of Pashyan api na pashyati mudho mudho mudho. You see and yet you do not see. So Swami says there are three reasons why you look at a mirror but you are not able to look at the reflection. One, there is a lot of dust and dirt that has gathered on the mirror because of which you are not able to look at the reflection. Second, the mirror is shaking and vibrating because of which you are not able to look at the image clearly. Or third, the mirror is covered with a thick cloth because of which you are not able to look at your reflection. And each of these three, Swami defines with a term saying, dirt or dust on the mirror is mala, a shaking and vibrating mirror is vikshepa, and a mirror that is covered by a thick cloth is avarna. So this is the story so far, and I think today we will be going into each of these kind of defects and ways in which we should overcome them.
I think before we go into the three, mala, vikshepa, avarna, when we did the 1990 series, Samukos, Shavanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam, I'm not exactly getting the name of the old student. There's the experience of one of the old students who had a one-on-one with Swami. And Swami was telling him that, you know, everything is an illusion. Everything is in the mind. Everything that you see is in the mind is like an illusion. And so then this thought came, then you are also illusion. Swami, you are there. So you are also an illusion. You are also in this world. Then how is it? Then Swami says, it is...
What is this from Swami or is this a thought?
It's a thought.
Okay.
And Swami answers, I'm not really actually remembering the story, but I remember the takeaway from the incident, which is in a sense more important for today's discussion. So he says, what's the difference between a see-through glass and a mirror?
Okay.
So he says, when you see through glass, you see what's on the other side. You see the world. You are wearing a glass as a spectacle. You see what is outside. But then he said, you coat it with love. That mercury is love. So moment you coat it with love, you see yourself. You see yourself in the entire creation. So he says, that is when you start seeing the entire creation as yourself. So he gives the analogy of mirror. When you are mentioning mirror, I just remembered that. Because the mind is, you know, compared to the mirror. And we see that anomalies in the mirror and compare it to the mind. But this is one perspective that when you start looking at yourself in the entire creation, that is, you see yourself in everyone. That happens when you look at everything with the only motive of love.
See, this is a very beautiful analogy because Bhagwan gives another analogy of a sculptor who is, you know, making the idol of Bhagwan Krishna from a stone. And he says that it is not as if the sculptor creates Krishna. Yes. Krishna is already in the stone.
Yes.
He chops away all that is not Krishna and Krishna stands revealed. So also he says each one of you is already an embodiment of love, an embodiment of purity, you are all divine. So my job is only to clear that. So I think we are already those, we are no longer those glasses, we are already the mirrors. There is that coating of love. But as Swami beautifully says in this discourse, in spite of being a mirror, we are not able to see ourselves.
Exactly.
And that is where we will be discussing Mala, Vikshepa and Avarna.
Yeah, I think, let me add a little more confusion to that. You know, the way I look at it, because it explains a lot of things the way we understand. First of all, starting with this idea of the mind being a mirror, I think Swami also mentions in one of those discourses, he refers to that Dakshinamurti Stotram.
Yes.
You know,
Vishvam Darpana Nagari.
And there's one of the monks who gives a very beautiful explanation for that. He says, when you're driving away from a city, you know, when you're visited a city, and let's say late in the night, you're driving away from the city, in the rear view mirror, you see the lights of the city fading away behind you as you're driving away. He said, you know, the essence of that Dakshinamurti Stotram is the world that you see is like the world that you see on that rear view mirror. No, you don't see it directly, but you see it reflected off a mirror in front of you. And that mirror is the mind. So every time you have a view of the world, it is flawed because of these flaws of the mind, which is the mind is shaking, the mind is having a layer of dust, the mind is having a thin cloth over it. So what you see of the world is actually the world filtered through the flaws of your mind. That is one aspect. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, Dakshinamurti, the whole concept of Dakshinamurti, just to elaborate on that, is so beautiful because here is the Lord who eloquently communicates through silence.
Right. You
know, the only thing he does, he's eternally young and he's just communicating through silence. And the beauty is that his disciples are not like, you know, anyone. They are like renowned scholars and saints and sages. Those who have crossed a certain level of understanding and comprehension, they are his students. And he communicates this idea that the entire world is like a reflection in a mirror. So that is the first shloka of the Dakshinamurti Stotram. So he says, why does he say that it's like a reflection in the mirror? So when you say that the mirror is reflecting the entire creation, that means you are not in the creation. You are the one looking at the creation. So also, when you compare it to the mind, and you say that everything in this creation is reflected in the mind, you are looking at the mind. You are not part of the mind. So what does that include? It includes your body. It includes your mental capacity. It includes your intellect.
It includes even the ahankara, which is part of the mind.
It includes everything except you. So it says, you are the witness, you are the subject, everything else is an object.
Right.
So, just to elaborate on that, it's exactly. Like everything is a reflection in the mind, and many people and scholars use the word consciousness. So, possibly, you know, everything is a reflection in the consciousness. So, you are a witness to that consciousness.
Absolutely. I think that is the extension of what I was trying to tell, because, you know, one is you're looking at the world through the mirror, and as you also said, you also look at yourself through this mirror.
Yes.
So you don't have a way of looking at yourself without this aspect of the mirror. Mm. That is our current state right now.
Right.
I'm not saying that that's the only way. That's how we are doing it. Mm. That is how it becomes imperative to purify this mirror.
Right.
So that we get the actual view of the world. Mm. In fact, that is going to be the two types of mistakes which Swami speaks about.
Mm.
That is the best way to look at the world and to look at yourself. But the other twist is, whenever someone is looking at you, they are looking at you through the reflection of your mirror.
Mm.
So when I am looking at you, your mind is reflecting your real self through the mirror of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
That is why when I see you, even though you are the embodied soul which is perfect, I see a Sai Prakash
flaw.
With limitations,
yes.
With these problems and with these achievements and with these abilities.
This is the reason, you know, why Swami says you are not one but three.
Exactly.
The one you think you are the body, the one the others think you are the mind. Because it often arises this doubt as to why is it that what others think of me is the mind. What others think of me should be the body and what I think of myself should be the mind.
Mm.
But as you said, others are looking at us through the mirror, which is our mind. And therefore, the way others perceive us is our mind. Compared to the third person that we really are, which is the soul.
And that also explains, you know, when you see a perfected being, when you see a Mahatma, when you see someone who is realized, why is it that that person appears perfect?
Mm-hmm.
You still are actually looking only at his mind. But that mind has reached a certain amount of perfection and stillness that it reflects better that inner self which is there. But that is why, you know, Vedanta also speaks of the state which is above the mind, you know, the state of amanaska, that is when you really, when probably we can give the example of Swami, when you're looking at Swami, there is no aspect of the mind at all.
Exactly.
The only mind which is involved in this double reflection is only our mind.
Mm.
That one reflection is absent. So you are seeing him through the flaws of only your mind, and you don't have a mind there to give any kind of distortion.
Correct.
Which leads us to the other statement, yanta matramu evara talachina anta matrame
nidu. Exactly.
You are as much as each person appears to be, because there is no reflection from his side but only the reflection of our own minds.
Right.
In fact, before we go into mala vikshepa avarna, another analogy which kind of possibly, I don't know, you might have mentioned in your previous episodes, but that of, you know, watching a film. A movie.
Right.
So, there is this beautiful analogy, I think, which Swami also mentions in one of the discourses. He says, you go for a movie show, and when you're seeing the movie, you are affected by what is being seen, and you are smiling, you're crying, and you're involved in it. But at the end of the movie, does anything happen to you? Nothing has happened to you. You have just experienced a certain emotion. And he says, it's like that. When you go to the movie theater, the screen is the screen of consciousness, which is the mind. And he says the film is the mind. You know, it has your manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. It has a preloaded film of, you know, what you're going to go through, this, that. Everything is there in the film. So the film is put in front of the light. The light is the light of awareness. So when the light of awareness and the film of the mind is played on the screen of consciousness, We identify ourselves with the drama that's going on or with the film that's going on, and we feel sad and happy. He says, no, hello, you are just a witness. You are the one enjoying, watching the movie.
It shows what happens when you purify the mind completely. The film becomes blank. So there's nothing. You see only light.
So the closest that the mind can take you to realizing who you really are is the light or is nothingness. So basically, when the mind is absolutely purified, you just see light. That light of awareness, in that state of awareness, you are. Right. That's all.
There are two things to keep in mind in this. You know, one thing is, till you reach that point, you're not going to see yourself or the world as it is.
Right.
But till we reach that point, I think what we have to always remember is, we are only seeing our version of the world.
Mm.
We are not seeing the world as it is. And I think in a practical sense, that will remove a lot of confusion in life.
Right.
You know, how many times, you know, I always think of it this way. Let's say I go to the ATM and there's a person there. And let's say he does something which is a little
suspicious,
disturbing or nasty or something. So immediately I form an impression of that person. And say, this person is a little, bad person or a nasty person or whatever it is. You know, it's so funny that that person's lifespan might be 100 years or 80 years. In that 80 years lifespan, I see probably 2 minutes of that. And seeing that 2 minutes, the person in my world, the world which I've created through my perceptions, I've already put a tag on him.
Right.
You know, how far away from reality is that tag which I'm giving that person?
Mm.
I think the moment we realize that the world that we see is nothing but our perception or the reflection from our mirror, automatically it will give us a little bit of cautiousness with which we deal with the world and, you know, especially relationships that we do with.
Absolutely.
And that cautiousness, I think, will get us eager to find out what Mala, Vikshepa and Avarna are. Because
exactly.
That is what will ensure that our mirrors are pure and help us to see the world in its reality. So with that, I think we shall directly enter Mala.
Chapter 1, Mala.
Yes. So Mala is, as we said already in the last satsang, it is the dust that has settled on the mirror that prevents us from seeing our true selves clearly. And Swami says, this is the dirt that is created by the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. The interplay of these gunas creates this kind of dust, and as long as we are ruled or we are influenced by the gunas, Mala will definitely be there. So therefore, Mala is the dust that settles because of the influence of the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. The interesting thing to note is, it is not like sattva is the end all. It is not the ultimate state to reach. It makes it clear that we have to even overcome sattva to completely overcome Mala.
And the defining aspect of Mala is, you know, if we go into that, I think that Swami has spoken on many other occasions on this. If you, again, going back to the analogy of the mirror, you know, Mala is like the thin layer of dust.
Mm.
And the dust actually comes from outside. The dust is not part of the mirror.
Mm.
That which settles on the mirror is called dust.
Mm.
And when we don't do this act of wiping the mirror from time to time, that is when the layer of dust becomes thicker. So Swami says, even as you go through life, it will happen. A certain amount of Mala will get accumulated on this mind. And then for that, Swami gives a certain techniques which can be used to get rid of this dust from time to time, to ensure that, you know, it doesn't become so thick a layer that your perception of the world is completely gone awry.
So he says, actually, it is also an accumulation of what we have done in previous lives.
Right, right.
So he says, all these impressions are there in the chitta of the mind, and that reflects as dust on the mind, on the mirror. So what happens is, it's kind of preconditioned.
Right.
It's kind of preconditioned because of what we have been doing in the past. And so I think Swami gives, first of all, when you read what Swami spoken about Mala, first of all, we should know that there is a defect called Mala. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the first step. First of all, try to know that there is a mind. Then there is a reflection which
then you're not the mind.
You're not the mind. You're looking at your own mind, not at others' mind. And there is a defect called Mala. And he says, one way of consciously trying to purify the mind is to regulate one's food and living habits, ahara vihara.
This is very interesting because, you know, in this Swami speaks a lot about consuming good food.
Right.
And when we say good food, it is not just physically good food which is hygienic and nutritious. Swami speaks of three particular aspects here. He says, patra shuddhi, paka shuddhi and padhartha shuddhi.
Right.
Patra shuddhi is the cleanliness and hygiene of the vessel. Paka shuddhi is the cleanliness and hygiene of the cooking. And padhartha shuddhi is the cleanliness and hygiene of the items being cooked. And of course, the physical aspects we understand very clearly, that all three have to be clean and germ-free and all that. Like the vegetables that are grown. I remember, you know, when we used to travel in local trains in Mumbai, just on the side of the local train tracks, there would be cauliflowers and cabbages being grown. And the shocking thing is, all these would be grown from the direct sewage water coming from all these buildings. It shocked us, and you know, as a family, we took a conscious decision to try to find out regions which are in the outskirts of Mumbai so that we get vegetables that are coming from not the city. All the vegetables grown in the city will be filled with God knows what kind of filth. So, you know, I'm just saying, so that is the kind of care we take when we speak about vegetables. It's not that they just look good there. You just see the kind of environment where it's growing. But even that becomes only physical. Swami would take it to the subtle level and say, what are the thoughts of the farmer who is growing those vegetables?
Correct.
Has he cheated somebody to get that vegetable? And it doesn't stop with the farmer. Has your servant cheated the farmer and bought the vegetable? With what thoughts are the is the food being cooked by the cook?
Correct.
And all this, you know, has to be taken care of. Otherwise, it is going to lead to dust forming on your mind. That is mala. In fact, in order to counter this only, we used to all the sannyasis of yore, even to this day, have the concept of swayampaka, where they grow their own vegetable, they cook their own food, and they eat only what they have cooked. Going to the extent that if somebody else cooks it, they rather go fasting rather than eat and dirty the mirror of the mind.
I think the other important point that has to be remembered is, you know, Swami had, had mentioned this in another discourse. When you say about padartha shuddhi, the purity of the ingredients which are bought, Swami says that it also includes by what means you have procured the wealth to buy these ingredients. And I think that is something which we often forget. You know, we think, oh, this supermarket gives us good vegetables, and you know, this shop gives us good grains, let's buy from there. But Swami says if the wherewithal to buy those ingredients has been earned in an unrighteous manner, even that goes into the food. And Swami would say that, you know, that's why in earlier generations, and you know, in times of yore, they used to be so careful that they should not get any form of unrighteous wealth into their house, because that will become food for their children. Right? You know, you might be about 50, 60 and ready to kick the bucket, but you are going to feed that food to the younger generation and eventually spoiling their mind for time to come. And, you know, the stories which Swami would say about those two farmers fighting, that the gold found under the earth which I have sold to you belongs to you. They used to be so scared, literally scared because of this, because any even little bit of money which is got through a means which is not even remotely, which is remotely impure, is going to add to this mala of the mind.
In fact, I just, you know, I was remembering a very nice encounter I had with the famous chef Sanjeev Kapoor. You know, he is he hosts lot of these cookery shows in Food Channel.
Right.
And I think on multiple occasions, he has got the opportunity to cook for our Prime Minister Narendra Modi also.
Right.
Yeah, so I had a chance, you know, having breakfast with him. So I was just asking him, what is your favorite item? What is your favorite dish? And he says, of course, masala dosa I can have any day of my life. And I can have every day of my life. But he said, more than that, any home-cooked food is my favorite. I was so amazed with that answer. He says, home-cooked food, and this is coming from a chef. He says, see, when I go home, my mother cooks for me. And home-cooked food is different. You may go to the best 5-star restaurant, you may go to, and I, you know, when I was speaking to a few of them, those who regularly eat in the best of hotels, you go anywhere, but when they come home and they have home-cooked food, it is different. The same item.
And definitely, that difference comes at a subtle level.
Exactly.
Because at a gross level, definitely the chefs in 5-star hotels or 3-star hotels or even ordinary restaurants, they make tastier food possibly than what is made at home. But that whatever, that feeling of warmth, that good vibes, love that
and
comes.
The positivity.
In fact, I think, if I'm not wrong, it's Sanjeev Kapoor who wrote a book. In fact, he literally did a research. How is it that in spite of all the care that we are taking as chefs, our food is not tasting as tasty as home-cooked food?
Oh, really? I
recall very long back listening to an interview which he gave. He said, the only thing we can tell is love, but that is not something which can be quantified. But it seems to be making so much difference.
Absolutely.
I remember Swami would maybe this is a slight aside, but Swami would narrate the importance of these subtle vibrations. He would say that when Rama, Lakshmana and Sita were going in their exile, he says, suddenly at one point in time, Lakshmana starts scolding his elder brother. An elder brother, you know, this is Lakshmana, to whom Rama says, build a hut at a place of your choice, and he breaks down, telling, brother, why are you condemning me like this, as if I have a choice that is different from yours. And such a brother is scolding Rama and saying, Rama, what a stupid thing you have done, what a foolish thing you have done, this is what it is, you should not have listened. You know, you should have been more firm, and starts giving advice to Rama, telling him how he, what he did was wrong and all that. And Rama is very calm and he says, Lakshmana, let's just keep walking. He just keeps walking. And after some time, Swami says that Lakshmana repents. He says, Rama, I'm very sorry. I don't know why I spoke to you like this. I'm feeling very sad and bad. And Rama says, you know, that is what happens because of the food. In that region, that is the region that is dominated by Thataki or Shurpanaka. I forgot. One of those two demonesses. And therefore, all the food, the berries, whatever we are eating, it is sattvic. In other terms, physically it's sattvic food, but they are all permeated by the feelings of those demonesses.
Negativity.
And that is why that negativity came in you also. In fact, Swami also narrates that another chinakata of a sannyasi,
yes,
who feels the temptation to steal the silver tumbler of the householder who is serving him food.
Correct.
So, coming to the end of, the solution, what do we do then? I mean, if Lakshmana could get affected, if a sannyasi is getting affected, how do I ensure that I grow my food? I mean, you know what? My state is such that I'm not confident that if I grow, I cook and eat my own food also, I'll be pure, because I don't know how my mind state is when I'm cooking. And that is why, you know, Swami says that there is one shloka in the Bhagavad Gita, which says, Aham Vaishwanaro Bhutva Praninam Deham Ashrita Prana Panasamayukta Pachamyannam Chaturvidam, which means, I am that fire in your stomach that digests the food, and I am digesting the food, I am taking in all the food. He says, this Brahmarpanam prayer, when you start off by saying, I am offering to Brahma, I am offering to the Supreme Lord, and the Supreme Lord answers in return, saying that, you don't have to make a separate offering to me, because the fire, the digestive fire within you that is digesting the food, that is only me. Swami says, sincerely, if we do this food prayer, anything and everything that we eat becomes an offering to God. It becomes naivedyam to God. And once we make it as naivedyam to God, what we are partaking is prasadam. And prasadam is purified of all the negative, subtle tendencies. And that is, you know, for Kali Yuga, Swami always gives such shortcuts, such easy solutions. He has said, Namasmarana is the only sadhana you need to do. For food also, instead of Patra Shuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi, Paka Shuddhi, Swayam Paka and all that, Swami says, just ensure that before you put that first morsel in your mouth, you close your eyes, dedicate it and make it as an offering to God through this prayer, Brahmarpanam. And in that manner, you will ensure that you are not further dirtying this mirror through the subtle tendencies of food.
In fact, it's very interesting, because I used to always wonder, you know, this Brahmarpanam and Aham Vaishwanaro Bhutva, these are two separate shlokas. And you know, it takes someone like Swami to put it together. We are so pampered and spoon-fed. He said, okay, just chant this shloka. If you see, Brahmarpanam is verse 24 of chapter 4. And Aham Vaishwanara is verse 14 of chapter 15. Now, Bhagavan takes something from chapter 4 and something from chapter 15 and puts it together. He says, this is your mantra for food. How amazing it is.
Beautiful. Really beautiful. In fact, in that discourse, it's amazing how Swami takes this concept forward. Swami says that, don't stop with this. He says, Brahmarpanam and all this as an offering to God comes when it comes to food. He says, but this kind of dust you can accumulate through your actions as well. So he says, in just like you do with food, if you are able to dedicate all your actions, do every action that you do as an offering, as an naivedyam to God, then you can be 100% sure that nothing that you ever do will ever cause any dust forming on the mirror. And that's why Swami says, karma phala tyaga and nishkama karma, that is the way to ultimately ensure that you do not get affected by mala.
And you know, Swami explains this, you know, with relation to food and actions. You know, when talking about food, Swami will, I think in one of the discourses, Swami beautifully says the gross part of the food actually comes out as excreta. It never stays in the body.
Mm.
It's the subtle part of food which becomes the nutrients and it starts nourishing the muscles and, you know, the flesh and the bones. The subtlest part of the food goes to the brain, the mind. You know, it starts forming the thoughts in your mind. And, you know, this is the subtle part which gets adulterated when that Pakshuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi and the three forms of impurity are there. So Swami says that is what you're trying to deal. The same thing is with actions also. You know, when you do, let's say, as part of your profession, you do a job, probably the most gross thing that you get in return for that is the salary that you get or whatever remuneration you get in that form. That is the gross part. Probably the subtle part is whatever joy you feel from doing that or for whatever fulfillment you feel by doing that.
Or but even the frustration you feel doing
that. Right, exactly. And the subtlest part is what you believe is, I have done this action and I should have a consequence for this.
Mm.
But Swami says that, you know, you cannot escape from, it gets part of your, you know, the chitta aspect. And that is the desire which actually brings you, whether you know it or whether it's in the conscious part of your mind, it keeps propelling you to come again and again. So Swami says the only way of snapping that is, do nishkama karma. Do actions and at the end of it you say, Saishwar arpanam astu. And then I have nothing to do with the results of this, good or bad.
Yeah, in fact, he clarifies that in the Gita Vahini. He says, can anybody do an action without expecting result? You are hungry. You eat food so that your hunger is satisfied.
Hmm.
He says, nishkama karma, the definition of nishkama karma is a little bit different. He says, nobody can act. It's impossible to act without expecting fruits of action. But you have a choice what you do with the fruit of action. He says that if you offer to God and you don't, you know, own it, you don't own the fruit of action, you have a choice. He says,
just to clarify here, don't own it means you don't feel pride at it, nor do you feel self-critical about it.
Exactly.
I mean, usually it happens that I write an exam, if I get top rank, I'm very proud about it.
Right.
If I fail, I self-condemn. So correct. Both self-condemnation and self-praise, both are signs of ego and me taking authority over the fruits of my action.
That's why Swami explains, he says, Krishna says, karmanyevadikaraste ma faleshu kadachana. He didn't say na faleshu kadachana. He says, if he says, don't expect fruits of action, it is na faleshu kadachana. He says, ma faleshu means, don't think that it is mine. Don't have that attachment to the fruit of action.
Whatever
to the lie. This thing, ma and na, there is a difference between ma and na. And Swami,
in this context, I remember a very nice quote I read, I don't know whom it is attributed to, but it says, work as if everything depends on you, and having done that, rest as if nothing depends on you.
Exactly.
Right, I think that more or less completes the mala aspect. And as we said, you know, this mala aspect is not something which can be overcome in one day,
yes,
or a crash course of or a retreat, a summer retreat, anything like that. This is something which is collected over many, many births. And over a lifetime, when you lead a lifetime filled with these things, when you offer every action to God, when you first of all ensure that you lead a dharmic life, that way you ensure that these impure impulses don't get into your mind, further doesn't cloud your mind. And like this, when you lead lifetimes and lifetimes, Swami says that over a period of many lifetimes, the mala gets removed from the mind.
That was very encouraging. But just to just to conclude the mala, you know, in summary, you would say that it is more linked to the karma marga. Swami would say, cleaning of the mala is more related to the path of action. You have to actually do something. But also to add a footnote here, that when we talked about food and purity of food, it's everything that you take through all the senses. Right. I think that we didn't specifically mention. Food is anything that goes in through all the five senses. What you see is food, what you hear is food, what you speak is food, what you smell is food.
I recall something which our Shastri sir from Vrindavan used to tell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Swami would often say that you just take one teaching of mine and you follow it and that is enough. You don't have to do anything more.
Mm.
So he said to himself, you know, that's a very encouraging thing. So let me look for the simplest thing which Swami says and I'll hold on to that.
Mm.
Then he was scouting through whatever Swami says and then he said, Swami says don't waste food. He says, that is something which I can follow. So he said, very religiously he started following that. Whenever he would eat in the hostel, he would not leave even a leaf or a clove or a you know, pepper. He'd eat everything and he would feel very happy, you know, I'm following Swami's message. Then one day, in a discourse, Swami said this, that you should never waste food. So he felt very happy. You know, Swami, this is one thing I follow. Then Swami said, what is food? And there came all his hopes crashing. Because Swami said, everything that you take into your body through any of your senses is food, not only what you put into your mouth. Right? And that is where it expands the concept and the scope of purity of food.
So instead of ending on a discouraging note, going back to the encouraging note, I still feel that though food is all these, a good starting point would be food as we understand as food, what we eat with our mouth.
Right.
Because, you know, I was reading one of the discourses that, I don't remember the date, but during the Dasara of 1962, in that, you know, Swami is speaking very strongly and saying that there are people who think that in this yagna, I am wasting ghee by pouring it into the yagna kunda. What is the use of this? Why don't you feed other people? And Swami says, my question is, those people who are asking this question, they have been feeding ghee for so many years. What is the benefit they have done for society? You know, it's as good as, so who are you to judge waste? It's as good whether I pour it in the yagna kunda or you eat it, it's the same for me. But then Swami goes on to say that, you know, it is only a fool who tells that a farmer scattering the grains on the land is doing a wrong thing because he can use the grain to feed others. They don't realize that those same grains will come a thousandfold, which can feed 1,000 more people. And Swami continues, you know, so beautifully. He says in the discourse, he says, how is the rain formed? The rain forms because of the particles in the air. And, you know, that is the scientific truth. The condensation happens where water vapor condenses on different small particles. And Swami says, when those particles happen to be the smoke from the yagna, the rain is bound to be good. Again, this, we can look at it in two fronts. One, from a scientific, physical point of view, the smoke from the yagna is completely combusted. You know, it is white smoke, unlike black or grey ones, which means there is no carbon monoxide or, you know, semi-formed, semi-burnt particles in that. It's completely combusted carbon dioxide and particles, compared to, say, you know, smoke belching out of our chimneys and industries and other things. That's at a physical level. Even at a subtle level, just imagine all the smoke, all the particles that are being thrown out from our industries. What is the motive? Any industry exists for profit. It's for selfishness. That is the subtle motive there. Whereas in a yagna, Swami says, the motive is samasta loka sukhino bhavantu. So he says, clouds that are formed and rain that comes because of smoke from the yagna is good rain. And that good rain gives rise to good food. And again, good food is not just physically good food, but at a subtle level also good food. And that anna, Swami says, that anna leads to good tan. An, jaise an, vaise man, Swami says. So just the way the food is, that is how the mind is. So, you know, it is also intricately interrelated. And once we understand it, we will realize what is the importance of all these so-called rituals of yagna and all that. We won't look down upon it. And because there is so much involved in it, that's why I said, even though it is complicated, even though it is a very difficult thing to ensure that all the food that we take from all the senses is pure, a good starting point would be to ensure that the food we take from our mouth, the gross food that we take, is pure in all terms, gross as well as subtle.
Right. I think we'll take a short break here before we go to the next aspect or the next flaw in the mind, which is vikshepa. And I think that is where, as we were discussing, there can be more solace can be drawn from this aspect. Because I think it's also important to know that without even knowing these concepts of the mind and the flaws of the mind, how Swami has put us in a path where many of this can be dealt with. I think that is something which we will learn when we talk about the next aspect. But as I said, we'll take a short break and we'll come back to that.
Brahmani manas san chagale
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just concluded our discussion on mala, you know, where Swami emphasizes that the best way to get rid of that defect is through the karma marga. In fact, Swami quotes shloka. He says, Shreyo jnanam abhyasat, jnanat dhyanam vishishyate, dhyanat karma phala tyaga, tyaga shantir anantaram. Meaning, better than practice is jnanam, which is wisdom. Better than wisdom is dhyana, meditation. Better than dhyana is karma falatyaga, offering the fruits of action, what we elaborated on. And when you do this, offering the fruits of action to God, you are assured of relentless and eternal shanti, peace. So, karma marga is the remedy, solution to cleanse the mind of mala. Then we come to Vikshepa. Vikshepa is the shaking and moving mirror, the vibrating mirror, because of which the reflection gets distorted. And this is the wavering nature of the mind. This is the problem that Arjuna faced, you know, when he told Krishna, Chanchalami Manak Krishna Pramati Balavadrudam. I find it more difficult to control the mind rather than control the wind, because the mind is very chanchal. Chanchal meaning wavering. So this wavering nature of the mind is another problem which makes viewing the reflection clearly. So this is called Vikshepa.
In fact, it's very interesting, because when you mention that Chanchalami Manak Krishna, Krishna says, Asamshayam Mahabaho Mano Durnigraham Chalam Abhyasena Tu Kaunteya Vairagyena Cha Grihyati. So he says, Abhyasa, practice. And
Vairagya.
You get Vairagya, you can even get Vairagya with practice. And just even in the previous shloka that you said, Shreyohi Jnanam Abhyasat, Swami emphasizes that practice is very important. And in spite of quoting it maybe 100 times, I would still quote it again. When Dr. John Hislop asked Swami, we know all these concepts. Now, like how we are talking about Mala Vikshepa, we just concluded a discussion on Mala, but the practice of removing Mala has to go on for lifetimes together. So we know these concepts, but why aren't we able to actually live them and practice them and achieve the goal? Swami says, you are not interested enough. That's it. You are not interested enough.
It's so not that, yet a priority for you.
Yeah, it's not your topmost priority. So I think this whole idea of abhyasa or practice, focused towards this particular cleaning of mala. Okay, it's not as if the first 3 hours of the day I clean mala, then next 4 hours I clean vikshepa, then third part of the day I clean avarna. No, it's an ongoing process of cleaning all the defects of the mind together.
And I think, as you're saying, it all starts with interest.
Right.
It all starts with the interest to see yourself in true light. You know, that's what Swami says.
Exactly.
If you don't mind being flawed in your perception, then you will never make the attempt to clean the mirror of the mind.
In fact, right? He says this very beautifully. He says, just as water cleanses the body,
right,
the truth cleanses the mind.
Swami says,
how do you cleanse your mind? It's the truth, that pining to know the truth, that's what cleanses the mind.
Right.
No wonder that as a solution for Vikshepa, for this wavering nature, Swami says that you have to put in efforts. And as you rightly said, for putting in the efforts, you definitely need to have it as a top priority. That's why Swami says, you bend the body, mend the senses and end the mind. I mean, that is the ultimate solution for everything. So in order to help in this, in order to help in bending the body, mending the senses and ending the mind, you know, Swami prescribes the Navveda Bhakti Marga. It is so beautiful, because, you know, I was thinking, suppose I want to become fit in my body. I want to lose some weight. And this has been my state of mind from the last 3 years now, anyway. So, I want to lose weight. If I'm given a choice between jogging every day versus playing shuttle badminton every day, I automatically pick shuttle badminton. Why? Because, you know, I love shuttle badminton. I like it. So when I go and exercise there, when I exert myself, spend energy, and I'm trying to burn down fat, that burning down fat is happening automatically. What is actually happening is I'm enjoying my game, which somehow, because of my own attitude and my own mentality, I don't enjoy jogging so much. So jogging seems like a chore, while badminton feels like games. So when I do that game, when I do something that I love, it becomes easier for me to achieve my objective rather than do it as a compulsion. And Swami would say, you should do it from source and not from force. And I feel that is why Swami is prescribing for us the Navvida Bhakti Marga, the path of devotion. Because the path of devotion will ensure that this bending the body, mending the senses and ending the mind becomes pleasurable. Because we do it out of love for God, not out of a hatred or fear for Vikshepa.
And, you know, going back to that shloka, the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna, Krishna says that, he says, you know, this is the nature of the mind. You know, when Arjuna presents his problem, the first thing he says is, look, understand that this is the nature of the mind. So I think the first step is, just like how we were talking about Mala even in Vikshepa, to understand that the nature of the mind is wavering. Right, I think that will first of all give us more compassion in dealing with others.
Correct.
And a certain amount of compassion in dealing with ourselves. And also not to take ourselves too seriously at sometimes. You know, that becomes very, very important. Because I think in one of the afternoon satsang we had spoken about how Swami says that when you feel a surge of devotion within with you, don't take that to be real. Because that could, might as well be just emotion. Because the whole idea of this vikshepa aspect of the mind is, the mind has this tendency to take the shape of the situation it's in.
You know, just a small quote that I was reminded, it is said that angels have wings and angels are able to fly because they take themselves lightly. You know, the importance of not taking ourselves too much seriously.
Right, absolutely. Because, you know, the mind always changes depending on the situation. You might think that you're very righteous, you might think that you're very calm, but it's just that you're not being tested enough. If put in a different situation, you realize that your mind changes. And to be aware of that. And, you know, Swami says, how do you handle this thing? The mind is always wavering. So the best option is put it on something which is stable. Mm. Right? If you're a person, let's say you have a disease by which your hand is shivering or something like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, you put yourself on something which is firm, right? Mm. That's how you stop the wavering of your hand. Swami says, in the same way the mind is wavering, put it on something which is more stable, and that is the Lord Himself. And that's why Swami says all of these things of Shravanam, Kirtanam and all of these ways by which you dwell the mind on the Lord is one of the best ways to stabilize the mind over a long period of time.
And I think I'll use this opportunity to quickly insert an advertisement, because in the afternoon satsang we had done an entire series on this Navveda Bhakti Marga, taking each one for two sessions, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam. So dear listeners, if you are further interested to know what Swami has said about these different nine paths of devotion, the examples He has given and how it can inspire us to take up the path of our choice, do go to our archives and download the afternoon satsang on each of these nine paths of devotion.
So that's a beautiful thing. You know, the first part Swami is saying mala has to be dealt with doing good actions, making right choices in life, and bringing purity in even in the physical aspect of life, not just in the mental aspect. The surroundings and the purity of that affects your mind. So Swami says, first thing is action. It is all based on action. The next thing is bhakti. Mm-hmm. That through the process of even bhajans, you know, listening to, being in satsang, reading good books, all of this also stabilizes the mind.
In fact, it's very interesting, because in this 1990 summer course series, where in this discourse called The Vagaries of the Mind, when he's talking about this defect of vikshepa, he's giving the example of youth today.
Right.
And he says, the youth need concentration. And you get concentration when your mind is steady. And he says, he talks a lot about youth wanting to go abroad, wanting to earn a lot of money, wanting to make big in their life and their career. So that is kind of a distraction. You know, it's like wavering mind where, you know, you think, oh, money is going to help me. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And speaking about patriotism, Swami, you know, had that in every discourse, almost definitely on convocation days, he would invariably bring the spirit of patriotism. And for your mind to be focused on the right priorities of life, is money everything for me? And is name and fame and success everything for me? Why can't you dedicate yourself to this country which has given you birth and fostered you all the while? Why do you want to go abroad? Because he beautifully connects that with the idea of having control over vikshepa. Because ultimately the concentration that is required to focus on the right things in life is also got by a steady mind.
Getting your priorities in order.
Absolutely.
Because the mind is unsteady, your priorities also keep changing. And as Professor G.V. would nicely put it, he would say, how can you play football if your goalposts are constantly changing? You need a fixed goalpost, then you can play the football properly. So also, I think we need to definitely fix our priorities in life. And it is best that the ultimate goal in life becomes our priority. If God is not our priority, how can you have anything else as a priority? Another interesting thing that we will observe is that these are not independent, you know. It is not as if cleansing of mala is independent from cleansing of vikshepa.
Exactly. Like I said, 3 hours in the morning for mala, 3 hours in the night.
When we develop this bhakti, when we start developing love for God, we will see that automatically Nishkama karma and karma falatyaga also become easy. You know, when I love God the most, bhakti is defined as love for God. Swami says each kind of love has a name. We have vatsalyam, we have sneham. In that, the highest form of love is bhakti, the love between God and the devotee. So when we have this love for God, offering all the results of our action to Him becomes easier.
Right.
Therefore, when we take up the Navvida bhakti, it automatically helps in cleaning up mala also, just as when we start doing karma falatyaga, it helps in developing love for God also. So, each of these processes reinforce one another, and I'm sure that when we go and discuss the methods of solving avarna, we will see that also reinforces all these. So, mala, as we discussed, is combated using the karma marga, and Vikshepa, Swami gives the solution of Bhakti Marga, and He says, choose, there are 9 different forms, choose any one, and automatically you will be able to overcome this wavering nature of the mind, because it will be held steadfast and steady in contemplation of the Lord, in the way that you have chosen, be it Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, any of those 9 forms.
In fact, one of the most amazing analogies Swami gives about realizing that karma, bhakti and jnana are one and the same. There is no difference between the three. He says, it's like eating a Mysore pak. He says, the height of the Mysore pak, the shape of the Mysore pak, and the taste of the Mysore pak. He says, you cannot affect one of them and not affect the other two.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take a piece of Mysore pak and put in your mouth, you are affecting its height, you are affecting its shape, and you are experiencing its taste. You cannot experience its taste without changing the shape. So he says, karma, bhakti and jnana are like that, like a Mysore pak. So when you go to Krishna Sweets the next time, remember that as you are melting that piece of Mysore pak in your mouth, it's just the same.
So it's just the same thing, the different aspects of the same thing.
I think the other thing which we have to learn from this connection that Swami is making between Vikshepa and all of these forms of devotion, it doesn't matter how many hours of bhajans that we do and how many hours we spend in seva or how many hours of likhita namajapam I do. The best way to quantify if what we are doing in the form of these devotional activities is working is our mind becoming more stable?
Right.
Are we able to concentrate better on things that we do? If that is happening, then you can be sure that this is working. Otherwise, there's something wrong in the way you're practicing all of these Navaveda Bhakti Marga, these attributes of devotional activities.
That's nice, because it gives us a qualitative way to measure rather than a quantitative. It's not as if I spend 2 hours in bhajans every day and therefore I will be spiritually advancing more than someone who would do only 5-minute bhajans. It reminds me of that story of Narada going around the world, which has been so beautifully made into an Uncle Lion's tale on the Radio Sai website. So it's about the quality, as Prem rightly said. If 5 minutes of bhajans every day is ensuring that my mind is steadier, more focused, and my priorities are always firm and correct, it is paying dividends rather than thinking that I have to do 2 hours of bhajans or I have to do akhanda bhajans.
Also, that beautiful story of Kannappa comes to mind. You know, he is a farmer and he is a tribal person. And
hunter.
So when he goes to the Shiva temple, they eat non-vegetarian food. They kill animal and that's how they eat. So every day he freshly from the hunt, he gets an offer
of meat
and
I remember he even makes offering of water with his mouth. Because he thinks that Shiva needs water. He doesn't have all this kamandalu and all that.
Yeah.
So he carries water in his mouth and literally spits on the Shivalingam every day.
Exactly.
Now, if we were to move to the third aspect of the flaws in the mind, the avarna aspect, if mala and vikshepa is difficult to get away with, I think the avarna is literally the fundamental flaw in the mind,
right,
which causes probably every other problem in the mind. Because Swami says avarna is when you put a cloth over this mirror.
Right?
First of all, the idea of the mirror is so that you can be able to see the reflection. You know, some of you said see through the mirror, but for both things, you need the mirror to be uncovered.
Right.
But if it is completely covered by the mirror, or, you know, I would also like to think of it as, let's say the mirror has lost its alignment. you know, you're looking at the mirror to look at yourself, but let's say the angle of the mirror is changed and it is showing a completely different person, you will not be seeing yourself at all. You will be seeing a different person and thinking that that person is me. Because that's literally what happens because of this flaw of the mind. Because what you see in the mind is very, very far from the reflection of your true self. And that is what is referred to as avarana.
In fact, this will be the most problematic of the three, because in mala, you're able to see something, at least some semblance of truth. In vikshepa also the same thing, though it's vibrating, it's shaking, at least I have something. Once I get focus, I can, you know, see some clarity. But in avarana, there's nothing seen at all, because Swami says it's like a thick fabric that has covered the mirror. And Swami says that this fabric is made up of the six, the arshad vargas, the six enemies of man, namely kama, desire, krodha, anger, lobha, greed, moha, infatuation or lust, mada, pride, and matsarya, jealousy. He says these six, they form a thick cloak over the mirror and they ensure that you just cannot see the world or see yourself the way it has to be seen. It completely blinds you.
That's what, when you say it blinds you and it doesn't give you a clear vision, what exactly is happening? He says, it makes you identify yourself wrongly with the body.
Right.
That is the ignorance that it is causing. You know, this black cloth over the mirror, what it actually does to you is, yeah, of course, I am this body, I am this smart person, or I am this ugly person, whatever.
Going by that initial analogy you gave, it prevents you from seeing that you are a reflection of the world and the world is a reflection of you.
Right.
That it is that same one that pervades everything. You feel you're distinct from the world. That is why you get anger. You know, if we look at these a little deeper, we realize that anger, jealousy, hatred, all this comes because of that basic ignorance that there you is, and me are one.
There is duality.
There is duality, there is separation. Exactly. You are different. You are doing, what you are doing is bad, what I am doing is good. That is the cause for anger, that is the cause for jealousy. You are doing bad and just getting prosperity, I am doing all good and I am not getting prosperity. That is the cause for envy and jealousy. So all these six enemies of man come because of that basic flaw of not being able to see the oneness, or, you know, having that feeling of duality. So that is what is described as avarana.
I think that is why, you know, Swami is giving it both ways. One is, the avarana actually causes these things, kama, krodha, moha, and all of these six enemies are caused by this wrong identification with the body, and it further makes you believe more that you are the body and get more entangled in this ignorance.
A vicious cycle.
It's literally like a cycle. Yeah. You know, because it is caused by the idea of duality and it causes even further the idea of duality.
So at some point you have to try to break it. And, you know, Swami goes on further. He says, it's not just that these six forms, these six enemies are by themselves. Each of them manifests in multiple ways. For example, you know, Swami highlights mada. He says mada is pride. And Swami says pride itself takes many forms. He says there is dhana mada, which is pride of wealth. There is pada mada, which is the pride of influence and authority that you have.
Eight kinds.
There is saundarya mada, which is the pride of your beauty or handsomeness. There is yauvana mada, which is pride of your youth. There is kula mada, which is the pride of your caste or your family tree, your ancestors and all that. There is vidya mada, which is pride of your learning and intelligence. There is aishwarya mada, which is pride of your fame. And finally, Swami says, the most dangerous kind, which every spiritual seeker must be wary of, which is tapa mada. Swami says, pride of your spiritual attainments, you know. So, there are different kinds of pride you have to be careful of, and pride is just one among the six kinds.
And as Swami is saying this, no, I'm just thinking in the modern context, how many more types of prides are there? The pride of the number of Twitter followers I have.
Yeah, I think it'll all get classified under, you know, Aishwarya Mada.
Right, exactly.
So different modern variants of the same problem.
It's not even fame, you know, fame in
it's
that
virtual
time.
Virtual fame.
Right, virtual fame, which is absolutely, it's like smoke, it's got no base at all. Mm. Right.
I think we are complicating it further because, you know, first of all, it is said that this fame that you earn in the world, that itself is
unreal,
transitory, and that is virtual. Mm. In that virtual world, we create another virtual world and get fame there.
Exactly. And the beauty is, all of this is caused by losing sight of what we are. And, you know, whenever Swami speaks about this pride, I often think of this, you know, we are all given to that. Let's not talk as though that, you know, let the listeners not get the idea that we're mocking at people who are caught up in this pride because we are
laughing at ourselves. Yes.
Exactly, we're laughing at ourselves. But it's so weird, you know, when Swami used to stand on a podium and give us the greatest reason for pride. Swami would say, you and I are one, you are as divine as I am. There should be nothing which should give us more pride than that.
Correct.
But after that we would come and say, you know, I've noted down more of Swami's points than my person sitting next to me. The fellow sitting in front of me was dozing, but I was attentively listening. I mean, or any kind of pride which we could have. You know, I am taller than you, I am fairer than you.
And we'll camouflage that in a very nice manner. We'll tell, you know, by Bhagwan's grace, everyone around was sleeping, but I did not sleep. We think that it's some, we are expressing our love and devotion for Swami, but actually I am expressing my pride.
Exactly, and I mean, we are forgetting the greatest reason for pride, and we are still holding up because that's the only way we can compare. If everybody is one, I can never compare myself with you. So I find reasons to compare myself with you, and all those reasons are only based on this illusion that, you know, I am separate from you.
In fact, personally speaking, when it came to this point, I really feel for myself, this is one of the greatest things I try to constantly be aware of or wary of. This pride that comes when we say, no, by Bhagwan's grace. Though in words I am saying, by Swami's grace this happened, by Swami's grace this is happening, inside am I genuinely, you know, offering it completely to Swami? Because I see that a pat on my back makes my head swell and a criticism makes me completely deflated, which is a very clear indicator that I am not actually offering everything to Swami. Though I am saying, though before I start my speech or before we start anything, we offer it completely to Swami, that's only in words. It's a good thing that at least it has seeped into the level of thoughts and words. It has to start seeping into the deeds as well, because here I may fool everybody in the world, but I cannot fool myself, I cannot fool the resident Bhagwan inside me. And till that Bhagwan and till myself are convinced, it is not going to pay any reward or dividend in my experience.
So, just going by what you are saying, what is the proof that you have actually started putting it into practice? So possibly, suppose you are giving a speech and you say, I dedicate it to Swami. So after the speech, if three people come and tell you, oh, the speech was amazing, and if 10 people come and tell you it was horrible, or vice versa, it should not make any impact on you. I think, but that is the proof of...
but that doesn't happen at all. We float in the air.
No, and another point which you have to remember is, we are talking of pride, but even the idea of guilt and self-condemnation, all of that is also born out of the idea of avarna, where you feel that you are lower than some other person. That is also as much a different form of pride, actually speaking.
In fact, in a sense, I think that
different
also,
form of ego.
That also comes back to what Gautam Buddha said in the middle path. You give too much attention to the body, you are focusing on the body. You deprive the body too much, that also you are giving too much attention to it.
See, Prem, I think just to further highlight what you said, when Swami gives us those 8 forms of pride, dhana, pada, saundarya, by default we assume the excess. You know, dhana mada means pride because of excess wealth.
Right.
But the feelings of self-condemnation, thinking that I am a poor beggar, I have nothing, that's also ego. Similarly, saundarya, vidya, to think that I am an idiot, I am a dullard, I am a moron. Everything, you know, it's not just the positive. When we say saundarya, yauvana, kula, vidya, aishwarya, it is not just because of the excess of it, because of the dearth of it also, the kind of negative feelings we get. I think both of them are covered under mada.
And Swami says the only way to, one of the most effective ways to deal with it is, you know, what Swami would refer to as swadhyaya. You self-study. You know, I think that is something which really is lacking today. I mean, not because of anything else, but because of a trivial thing like we don't have time. You know, you actually are so much in a hurry that you don't have time to pause and look at your own thoughts, look at your own feelings. You know, where is this coming from? How it is absurd, actually, because if you look at the way Swami speaks at Avarna, it is all born out of absurdity. But you just need that time and a little bit of detachment to look at yourself and say, I mean, this is such a silly pride to have. This is such a silly feeling of guilt to have, because it is not mine. In fact, Swami tells that beautiful Chinnakatha of, Krishna and Karna and Arjuna. after Karna is slain, Arjuna comes to know apparently that it is one of his brothers, because Mother Kunti comes and cries in the battlefield. And then he realizes it's my brother, and he says, oh God, I've killed my brother. And he turns at Krishna and he starts shouting, you made me kill my own elder brother. And Krishna starts laughing. He said, what a fool you are. He said, see, first Indra came and took away his kavacha. There his first death happened. Okay. Then the guru curses him, saying that at the appropriate time you will not remember. He says that is the second cause for his death. And like that he names four or five causes for Karna's death. And like the final blow, your arrow killed him. Okay. And literally you're like the man who is stamping a dead snake and saying that I've killed the snake, I've killed the snake.
Correct.
And even that feeling of guilt, you know, Krishna says that only if you stop and think that, am I really the cause for this? And you will distance yourself from that pride or that ego or that guilt so much that self-study is what is important. And I think Swami says that comes from the self-inquiry, the path of self-inquiry.
Correct. In fact, that analogy which is given, like you think that your mother and father are the reason why you are born. But is the earth not a reason why you are born? Is the presence of the earth not a reason why you are born? Has it not contributed to your birth? Has not the sun contributed to your birth? There are a million factors that we do not know that actually affect what we think we are. And we are so easily taken in by pride and we say that I am able to deliver a coherent speech because of myself. No, there may be a million reasons because of which you are made to deliver a coherent speech.
As you rightly said, to get into this line of thinking, we definitely need to set aside time for it. I remember seeing a talk by one of, again, I don't know who it is. I always remember the thing that impresses me. I forget the names of the people. But he says that, I think it is Seligman, Martin Seligman. He says that two kinds of things we have to pay attention to. He draws a graph of things that are important and things that are urgent. He says things that are urgent and important, we anyway do. Things which are not urgent and not important, we anyway don't do. This is the most important. Things which are important but not urgent. And things which are urgent but not important. He says, all of us are so involved in things which are not important but urgent that we forget and we neglect things which are important but not urgent. When we look at this, you know, for example, moksha, realizing oneness with God, is very important, but possibly not urgent, because, you know, we have spent 84 lakh births already. We can spend some more births, no problem. Swami says ultimately everybody will reach it. It's just a matter of time. And when he says time, it's colossal time. So it's not urgent, but it's important. Whereas, you know, right now there's a match going on possibly between India and Sri Lanka, and what's the score there? That's urgent. Did he hit a century? I want to see him hitting a century. It's urgent. But possibly it's not important. But many times I'm lost in urgent but not important, that I forget what is important but not urgent. I think we have to take time out, refrain ourselves from doing things which seem urgent but are not important, so that we can divert that time towards things which are apparently not urgent but definitely very, very important for all the things that we wish to achieve in life.
Mumukshatvam, I think that is what is referred to as mumukshatvam.
The desire to
have attain liberation. And that is, again, in simple terms, that is interest.
Right.
Priority.
Priority and interest.
And the other thing which Swami says, apart from self-study, is Swami makes a very passing mention in that discourse itself, where Swami says, even perfecting your love is a process by which avarna can be removed.
Yes.
Because Swami would very often say, no, love is nothing but selflessness.
Yes.
Where you remove this, remove this idea that I am a separate self. That is what happens in any form of love. It's not necessarily only in devotion. In any form of love, when you go into the process of perfecting it, you eventually realize that, you know, the love is only because there, I mean, it's there because there is oneness.
See, again, this is beautiful, because on the face of it, it looks like the solution to avarna is jnana marga. Because Swami says you need to recognize the true I, not this body, but not the mind, but the atma. That is only the way to get rid of avarna. But Swami is also saying that, the best way is to make your love perfect.
Correct.
Which is like bhakti, you know. So as we discussed earlier, bhakti helps not just vikshepa, but also mala. But bhakti also helps avarna. In the same way, avarna reinforces the other two as well. So one thing that becomes very clear is karma, bhakti and jnana are not like three separate paths and I choose one of them for this lifetime. Each of them reinforce the other, and one without the other two is meaningless and useless as well. Sometimes dangerous too, because if there is jnana without bhakti and karma, it is just conceit and vanity. If there is bhakti without jnana, I mean, we'll never find. Think of any of the people whom we consider as followers of the bhakti marga. Take Mirabai. Didn't she do karma? Don't you think she had all the wisdom in the universe?
Correct.
I mean, it's impossible. Look at the greatest Advaitin of our times. Not our times, I mean of our whatever, scriptures. If you take Adi Shankara, do you say Adi Shankara doesn't have devotion, doesn't have bhakti and doesn't have karma? I mean, he, before the age of 32, he did two complete circulation of the entire country.
Correct.
Of the Bharata Varsha. How much of effort he has done? He has composed Mudakarata Modakam, many Ashtakams, Shatakams, Ashtakams, so many things he has composed.
Devotional. I mean,
yes. So, it becomes very clear that these are not three separate paths, but all of them reinforce one another, and definitely, if you are to measure yourself as following any one path, you definitely have to see the other two paths as well.
That story is also very relevant, where Swami says the mind or Maya is like the dog. And God is in the second floor of the mansion. He says, so when you go to the gate of the mansion, there are two ways you can reach the top. One is stand at the gate and shout, oh God, please come. This dog is troubling me. It's not allowing me to pass through. And then the master, as Swami says, will be on the second floor. And he'll look down and say, hey, keep quiet, Johnny, go inside. So moment he tells the mind, keep quiet, automatically you can go in. He says, that is bhakti marga. Or you go there and speak nicely to the dog, give it a biscuit, and then make it understand that you are not its enemy, that you are its friend, and you have come to see the master. That is jnana marga. You can just speak your way through and go in and meet the master.
And to do either of them, you need to do karma.
Exactly.
Either you have to call out or you have to feed the biscuit. So, I'm reminded of what Bhagya sir was saying the other day. One Swami came out and Swami told him, Tumara naam kya hai?
Mm.
He told Bhagya. Swami said, what is meant by Bhagya?
Mm.
He said, Bha is bhakti, Gya is jnana.
Wow.
He said, bhakti and jnana must be the two banks between which the river of karma flows. That is what is the meaning of your name, and I think that's a message for all of us. Our action constantly has to be between the banks of bhakti and jnana. And it also shows the unity between these three.
Correct.
Any one of them is missing, you don't have a river. You know, if karma is not there, there's no river only. If bhakti or jnana, one of the banks is missing, it's no longer a river because it's a flood in the nearby area and there's no river flowing. So for the river of life to flow on, we need all the three, bhakti, karma and jnana.
And what we were referring to initially, you know, see, if you just going through all these three flaws in the mind and the solutions for it, we realize that whether we have learned this concept or not, whether we have understood this concept or not, just probably by being devotees of Swami, say regularly coming to Prashantinilayam or regularly going to a Samiti, without our knowledge we are indulging in all of these solutions which result in not just purifying the mind for this birth. It is that, you know, it's that journey over many lifetimes which is happening in this lifetime when we just follow Swami's things. All of this, you know, we might not do self-enquiry. We might not sit and say that, am I the body, am I the mind? Probably not all of us have the taste for that. But even this fact of sitting and listening to Swami's discourse where Swami is repeatedly saying that, you know, as you recall that beautiful statement that Swami said, the way you have bath for the body, you have to wash your mind with truth.
Truth.
And another way of doing it rather than doing it yourself is when you constantly associate yourself with that message. You're hearing that from Swami again and again, Swami saying that you're not the body, you're not the mind. That is another way of going through this process. And just by indulging in bhajans, just by doing seva, and just by trying to perfect the way you have love for people around you, and through this process of constantly listening to the truth. In fact, I think one of the youth was saying, when they asked Swami, Swami, you say that we are all divine, but I don't know how we're going to get there. Swami says, Swami asked them, what do I do?
Mm.
He said, what does Swami do? Swami says, I keep telling that I'm God, I'm God, I'm God.
Mm.
Swami said, you also do that. It is a means by which you are giving this information to your mind, and your mind will start accepting that as truth over a long period of time. So I think without our knowledge, Swami is making us do all of this. But I think if we do it consciously, there is going to be better benefit in that too.
And
at the end of a bhajan session in a samiti, it's not important whether you got a chance to lead the bhajan or you got a chance to play the harmonium or tabla. But at the end of the bhajan session, if you think that my mind has become more steady and focused towards the Lord, I mean, that's something very, very beautiful.
You know, as a concluding note, possibly there is this ninefold path, not ninefold path, nine guidelines that Bhagwan has given for the Sri Satya Sai Seva organization. It has been adopted worldwide. If we look at those 9 points, the 9 point code of conduct. Interestingly, you know, once I sat and actually categorized them, out of the 9 points, 4 of them pertain to the karma marga, 3 of them pertain to the bhakti marga, and 2 of them to the jnana marga. So though Swami has not said it explicitly, this is just my reading and my understanding I'm sharing. I just felt that Swami has not only shown that all the three are important, because all three are not independent, they are actually one coherent unit. I felt in a subtle manner, Swami has also indicated how much time, you know. For example, yes, I know I should spend time in jnana, I should spend time in bhakti, in activities that connote bhakti marga, karma marga and jnana marga. But how much time? You know, this is totally my understanding. I just felt by giving the number of points in that manner, Swami says do 4 times the amount of work, 3 times bhakti and 2 times jnana. So I feel, rather than saying that one day a week I'll do little work and sit throughout reading Swami's discourse, I don't think that should be the quantifying manner. My understanding is 2:3:4. That is the exact proportion that Swami has given. If we just follow the 9 point code of conduct, not only what should be done, but in what proportion it should be done also becomes so clear and easy. That's why I say we have been spoon-fed by Bhagwan.
Exactly.
We just have to follow what he has said.
He gives that example of the clock also. 60, right. The second hand is the karma marga, the minute hand is the bhakti marga, and the hour hand is jnana marga. He says ultimately if the hour hand doesn't move, there's no point of your second and minute hand.
But though the hour hand is most important, though everybody is interested to know whether it's 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, know that if your second hand is not moving, nobody is interested in the seconds.
Right.
But if the second doesn't move, that will not. So you cannot say which is more important, which is less important. All three are part. It's like again the other example where Swami says that karma is primary school, bhakti is secondary school and jnana is university. You can't reach university without going through primary school.
Correct.
Though ultimately people ask what is your degree, you definitely can't attain that degree without the primary school. So all three are equally important. And I think with that, dear listeners, we come to the conclusion of our entire discussion also on the mind, its defects and the ways to overcome it. It has been a very enlightening thing for all of us here, going through Bhagwan's discourse and trying to understand the mind so that we can incorporate his teachings and message better in our lives. We hope it has been interesting for you too. As always, you can write to us with your feedback, your suggestions, your thoughts, everything at listener@radiosai.org. So next week we will be going back to our Bhagavata Vahini Satsang. The next fortnight will be the Bhagavata Vahini Satsang. We hope you enjoyed this entire discussion spanning several fortnights on the mind. We offer this to Bhagwan with all our love and humility, and we conclude this satsang, leaving you behind with a song on the other side of which, as always, you will have the segment Love to Love.
रे मन अपने धाम, चल रे मन अपने धाम, चल रे मन अपने धाम, चल रे मन अपने धाम। इस जग में परदेश है बंदे, इस जग में परदेश है बंदे, भटक रहा क्यों सुबह और शाम, भटक रहा क्यों, चल रे मन अपने धाम, चल रे मन अपने धाम। आँख जो देखे वो झूठा सपना, आँख जो देखे वो झूठा सपना, सब है पराए कोई ना अपना, सब है पराए कोई ना अपना, चल रे मन, चल रे मन, चल रे मन, चल रे मन, चल रे मन।
Thank you.